It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We get the view of school social workers amid concerning trends in children's mental health. Governor Tony Evers has declared 2023 the year of mental health. Anxiety, depression, and suicide all increasing among youth in our state. And these findings in the new report from the State Office of Children's Mental Health. Call in with your questions about social services and schools. Share your experiences, access to mental health services during a school day. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Leah Kutschke is president of the Wisconsin School Social Workers Association and a school social worker at a Monona Grove School District Elementary School. Leah, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
We heard in Governor Evers' State of the State address last night that his budget will contain $500 million to expand mental and behavioral health care statewide. He called mental health a quiet, burgeoning crisis. How could more funding improve school social services?
Yeah, I thought that the State of the State address was just very exciting. I heard so many opportunities for great ways to support the mental health, not only of our students, but also of their families. Because as Governor Evers mentioned, adult mental health crisis is something that we are struggling with in the state and that affects our students and families as well. I think one of the things that I am most excited to hear about in Governor Evers' budget proposal is providing more funding to schools to reimburse them for costs to hire, recruit, or retain pupil services positions. So that's things like school social workers, school psychologists, school counselors, and school nurses, all of whom play a vital role in supporting the mental health of students and the physical health of students at schools. And one of the things that Governor Evers would like to do is to expand a currently existing program that provides that reimbursement for social workers to encompass all pupil services positions, which I think would be just a fabulous addition to many school districts. We also heard about training for staff for mental health to support student mental health. We have found through the pandemic that teachers and educators are many things, and one of those things is sometimes frontline crisis responders when students are in acute mental health crisis. Sometimes we are spending 8 hours a day with students, and they might not be spending that much time with their families even. So providing staff and educators and support staff with the tools to understand mental health, to support an acute mental health crisis, and help connect students with mental health resources like trained counselors. That, you know, the kind of training we provide for first aid should be the same type of training we provide for mental health first aid. So I was very excited to hear a lot of the things that were mentioned in the State of the State last night.
I wonder, as you talk with your peers about workforce and these other stressful issues, do social workers in the school setting have unmet needs themselves? Like, what about not enough staff and burnout and trauma in your profession?
I mean, those are definitely all things that are very present. And while I would say that overall, the state of social work in the state is strong, and we do have a lot of people choosing to enter the profession right now, especially people who have a master's in social work and have been doing other things and maybe want to join schools, we're also seeing record numbers of people leaving the field. That the stress of the pandemic, I think, wore a lot of people down, just as it did our students and families. And one of the things that is a unique challenge for school social work and for student services positions in general is frequently you're the only person in your building that is doing your role. And for school social workers in our rural districts and some of our farther corners of the state, you might be the only school social worker for an entire school district. So it can be an isolating position, and it can be a challenge to know who to bounce ideas off of, or to even be able to know what is your job and what's not. And that's why it's very important that we have organizations like the Wisconsin School Social Workers Association to provide these member networks with resources and with ideas and with professional development specific to school social workers. I cannot tell you how many professional development trainings for teachers I've sat through my school district, but it is very infrequent for us to get training from our school districts specific to the role of school social work. On top of that, I think that it's a taxing job. While there are many joys, I have a whole wall full of pictures from kids and I get lots of hugs, it is still dealing with challenges and helping students and families on some of their absolute worst days, and then waking up and doing it all again the next day.
Mm.
I will say that something I have heard from both teachers and social workers in the post-pandemic era is more, what's the best way to say this? Feeling more okay with prioritizing things other than work.
Hmm.
You know, before work, I had so many teachers and social workers who would be at work until 5, 6, 7 o'clock at night. And I think the pandemic and the changes of the last couple of years really refocused people. And so I will say that I, you know, teachers who are always there until 6 o'clock pre-pandemic are leaving at 3:30. I think we see people who have recognize that it is okay to say I'm at my limit, that it's okay to say I need to go home now. And so I think there are definitely some positives that have come. However, we are steering into one of the most difficult times of the year. If you talk to anybody who works in schools, February and March are hard, hard months. So maybe ask me that question again in April and I'll have a different answer for you.
I definitely want to follow up on that, but I want to reintroduce you, Leah Kutschke, president of the Wisconsin Social Workers Association, as we look more deeply at student mental health and school social workers, the work they do each day across Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to Andrew in Whitewater. Andrew, hi. Go ahead. What's on your mind?
Good morning. I just wanted to ask the guests what their thoughts were about the spike in children needing speech therapy following the mandates of people wearing masks, and then also what her thoughts were on the schools being shut down and largely a lot of other aspects of life being shut down, and how there was a massive spike in suicide among teenagers or suicide attempts. Those are just two things that I'd like to ask about.
That's coming up for you, Andrew. Thank you for joining in. Leah, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, I am not a speech pathologist. I am a school social worker, so it is hard for me to identify a correlation or a causation between mask wearing and students with speech delays. I think it can go without question that everybody, including adults, experienced adverse effects from being at home and from not being around peers. I think we have definitely seen an uptick in children who have struggled with appropriate peer relations because they spent some of those formative years not around people they weren't related to. So I can't deny that there are certainly things that we are working to address in our students, but I don't think any of those challenges are unsurmountable when it comes. Kids are very flexible, they are very resilient, and we as educators have responded and have developed social emotional learning lessons to address some of these relational concerns. And I, you know, you would have to talk to a speech pathologist to learn more about that piece, but I think it's just, it is something that it goes without saying that not being around our peers for adults as well for long periods of time can have adverse effects. However, I do think I have seen in the last two-ish years since schools have mostly been reopened that kids are catching up and kids are finding joy. And kids are leveling out to a place where we would like them to be with those social interactions and those academic supports.
But why? Oh, go ahead.
Go ahead.
If you're going to address the piece on suicide, and I would say that the crisis line is 988, but your thoughts there?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the exact same thing we saw with adults. Adult suicide rates also spiked during the pandemic, that when people were cut off by their social networks, when we were doing the things that we needed to do to stay safe, or even the things that we personally chose to do based on our own levels of risk, of comfort, of health, that there undeniably were adverse effects of people being anxious for such a long time, of people being isolated from social networks, of people losing employment and things like that. Personally, my school district did a combination of things. We were virtual, we were hybrid, we were in person, and I won't say that any of those solutions were perfect. We were dealt an impossible situation in a crazy time, and I think that most school districts did the best that they could with the currently available information. But unfortunately, that required us to be away from each other. Mm-hmm. I will say that a lot of school districts did amazing, amazing work during this time. the number of websites that I saw created of calming resources, of crisis resources, of open office hours, of, you know, people having their virtual link open all day, every day for students to come in. I think that there was a lot going on to support students and families in that time. And I think that a lot of people, myself included, are immensely proud of the work that we were able to do in such a challenging situation. But when people are isolated, and especially teens, when they're isolated with social media as one of their big influences, there's obviously going to be risks. And those are students who we are continuing to work to re-engage with school, work to support those mental health services. And it's part of why we need some of these mental health services to come back into schools. So sometimes these families still face barriers accessing those mental health services outside of schools. And being able to have things as a one-stop shop is beneficial for both students and their families who may be overtaxed with mental health or economic stress of their own.
Leah Kutschke leads the Wisconsin School Social Workers Association as we learn about the unmet mental health needs of our state's youth, how professionals in this role are thinking about these issues. Be part of our conversation, calling in with your questions, comments anytime. School counselors, social workers, psychologists, share your perspective, what you encounter, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're in conversation with the Wisconsin School Social Workers Association on the needs of mental health in schools across our state. The State Department of Public Instruction, in its $2.5 billion biennial budget request, outlines how it seeks to address student mental health. Call in your questions, comments, 800-642-1234. Leah Kutschke leads the Wisconsin School Social Workers Association and is an elementary school social worker. Stays with us. Let's go to Lisa now in Milwaukee. Lisa, hi.
Hello. Hey, I asked the question to the person that answered the phone. With that question, I was talking about teachers. I know of six of them that retired. They were elementary school teachers at one school after they went online. Is that something we could get those teachers back if they went to school for social worker?
Lisa, thank you. What are your thoughts there, Leah, about retirements and perhaps getting those teachers to re-enter the workforce in a social work setting?
So I do think one of the things that Governor Evers mentioned during his speech last night that I think was really interesting was creating some pathways for retired teachers to re-enter the field more easily. So, you know, I think personally, if those people have a teaching background, I would love to see them in front of students again, that we do have a huge need for educators and for people with experience to be in the classroom. So I was excited to hear Governor Evers talk about that. To address this question specifically, it would be, I think, a little bit of a challenge. In the state of Wisconsin, a school social worker is required to have a master's in social work. And while there are some pathways for people who already have a master's in social work, but maybe don't have the school certification to get that school-based licensure, unfortunately, I think it would be a little bit challenging for a teacher to go back and get another master's. And so I do think that the experiences of teachers are something that school social workers can absolutely learn from. Some of our best presenters at our conferences have been educators themselves to share those experiences. So while I think it might be a little bit challenging for a retired teacher to make that jump to school social worker, I think there's absolutely opportunities for partnership, for developing curriculum and resources that is benefiting students' emotional needs, but is written in a way that students can actually understand. And that's where we need educators, and we need people who have this boots on the ground experience with students to be our resources. Because while I spend a lot of time with students, my kindergarten teachers are with them for 7.5 hours a day. So they know a lot more about the kids than I do and the best ways for them to learn.
Which makes me wonder, could classroom teachers fill the gap in delivering some of the social and emotional learning needs? Or is that type of role better suited for mental health professionals and for social workers?
Yeah, that's a great question. The Department of Public Instruction's best practices are for what's called universal social emotional learning, which is kind of the basic building blocks of being a person. Things about kindness, empathy, understanding how to solve problems, understanding how to disagree with somebody respectfully. Research shows us and best practices show us that at least at the elementary level, it's really beneficial for those basic building skills to be taught by classroom teachers, because that's who's with the students all day, every day, and can reinforce those skills, can reference, well, remember, we talked this morning that here's our fair ways to play. And so what we saw in the past is that a lot of times that social emotional learning was delivered by a school counselor, a school social worker who would come in, do a lesson, and then leave. And there was a lot of difficulty with transferring those skills. So that kind of universal social emotional learning in a lot of districts and in a lot of places is already being taught by classroom teachers, because that's just what they do all day. Mm-hmm. There is certainly some content, what we call kind of tier two or secondary supports, where someone with a mental health background being the person delivering that content could be more appropriate. So these are things like small group interventions for students struggling with anxiety, or for students who've experienced grief or who've experienced family change. So some of those topics that are perhaps a little bit more intensive are frequently being administered by student services or in partnership with outside agencies. We're seeing a lot of districts bringing trained counselors, psychologists, people into the schools to provide those services due to the even higher level of accreditation and understanding of these concerns. So yeah, there's a lot of great things that can be done by teachers, and there's a lot of great things that can be done by social workers and outside people as well to support students while we have them in the building.
Wisconsin School Social Workers Association President Leah Kutschke with us as we talk about student mental health and how districts proceed in this area, 800-642-1234. Follow-up question, much earlier you said, you know, February, March is the most difficult time of year for school social workers. Why is that?
Oh, gosh, that's such a great question. I think it's a confluence of things. It is the long haul between winter and spring break can be challenging for a lot of students and staff. That's a long time to go without days off. We also are steering into the standardized testing time of year, which can provide a lot of opportunities for stress and anxiety, even for young learners. Frequently, that kind of starts in February, March, and April, that we start having to set aside large chunks of our day to stare at computers and to take these standardized tests. I also don't want to discount the fact that we live in Wisconsin and we've barely seen the sun for the last 2 weeks. And I think a lot of students and families suffer from that difficulty going outside, difficulty getting into nature, difficulty being out with friends and interacting in these kind of social settings. And we tend to kind of hunker down during those months. And it's not always the best thing for the adults or for the students.
Thank you for calling attention to that and explaining how that can really impact the school setting. So as we head into budget season here, Governor Evers delivering his budget address next month on the 16th. What are your association's priorities for the upcoming budget?
I think just thinking about that $6.6 billion that is Wisconsin taxpayer money and seeing how we can possibly get that back into our schools. I think a lot of schools received a lot of one-time funding through the coronavirus pandemic and were able to do things like hire companies to come in and provide therapy or to contract with agencies to help connect families. Unfortunately, a lot of that funding is going to run out. So I think whatever we can do to sustain the amazing work and focus on mental health that has come from the pandemic through funding to make sure that a great program isn't here 1 year and gone the next, I think that's a huge priority for us, as well as trying to recruit and retain school social workers and educators as general. We can have a lot of school social workers, but if we don't have teachers to teach the kids, we've still got a bit of an issue. So I think just a lot of the things that Governor Evers laid out as far as supporting student mental health, supporting school-based mental health services, which can be lifesavers for families in rural areas or families with limited access to transportation or outside services. These are all things that school social workers have been dreaming about for years. And so it was very, very exciting to hear about the proposed investments in supporting mental health and in supporting staff, so that we can keep these fantastic people in their jobs with students for as long as humanly possible.
Leah, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a delight, and thank you to the callers for some good questions as well.
Leah Kutschke is president of the Wisconsin School Social Workers Association. If you or someone you know is experiencing a mental health crisis, the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline is at 988. Free, confidential support, 3 digits, 988. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a Cuban refugee who lives in Madison. He's also one of the people featured in a new podcast, WPR Reports Uprooted. And as a warning, the story contains brief mentions of violence.
Osvaldo Durruti was sitting in a Wisconsin prison in the mid-1990s. He was in his 30s, and he was desperate to get out. He wanted to go home to Cuba. So he concocted a plan.
I had a sad moment.
And this sad moment led to something quite disturbing. In his mind, to get out of prison, Durruti was going to have to kill the most hated man behind bars.
I went little violent, you know. So, you know, inmates, you know, Jeffrey Dahmer, you know.
Durruti thought he'd get out if he killed Wisconsin's most notorious serial killer, Jeffrey Dahmer. And it almost happened in the prison chapel. But the weapon broke and guards intervened.
But I'm not proud of that. At that moment, you know, my mind was so disturbed. Because when I tried to kill him, the reason I did it because I want to go back to Cuba. I don't want to be here in this country anymore. I want to go back to Cuba.
But the assault never got Durruti deported like he hoped. So how did he get here? Durruti settled in Madison, Wisconsin, after coming to the United States as part of the Mariel boatlift, a moment in 1980 when 125,000 Cuban exiles were allowed to leave the island. Of that group, almost 15,000 were sent to Fort McCoy in Sparta, Wisconsin, including Durruti. At Fort McCoy, he made friends with a group of musicians who ended up playing for people across the state.
We all got together. We started, you know, playing music. And that was when I ended up going to different places. And that was my way out of the environment, the McCoy, you know.
Once Durruti was out on his own, he settled in Madison. He liked the people, the city, the nightlife. But discrimination and a language barrier made finding a job difficult. So he turned to the drug trade to make easy money. Durruti says he wasn't thinking about the consequences.
We were selling dopes, you know, we were stealing, we were doing the crazy thing, you know. I can never say regret because, you know, once I do something, I don't look back. If I pay for my mistake, I pay if I do wrong.
He paid for that mistake with a prison sentence, where he would later cross paths with a notorious serial killer. The sentence is also getting in the way of him going back to Cuba. He wants to return to see his family, like his sister, who he hasn't seen in person in more than 40 years.
The first thing I want to do, I want to embrace her and, you know, just raise her up, you know, and hug, give her the hug that, you know, nobody ever, she never get the hug from her, you know. And she say, what you're going to do is cook for me.
But he can't go back. Even though he's no longer in prison, Durruti has felony convictions, so he can't return to Cuba or become a U.S. citizen.
When I came here, I was wild and nothing good was on my mind. Now, you know, it's like, you know, I got better understanding what it's like to be an American citizen. And not only that, but putting me behind bars, it was something that I needed because I learned how to become a man.
And now, Durruti just wants a second chance.
We pay for our mistake, you know. We are not a threat to society anymore. We just want, you know, to ask for forgiveness, consideration, opportunity to, you know, grow as a man, as a father. You know, we're not perfect. We just want to, you know, be part of American dream, you know.
To learn more about Osvaldo Durruti's life in Cuba and Wisconsin, check out the podcast WPR Reports Uprooted. All 8 episodes plus historical photos, all at WPR.org/uprooted. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now to the model used in how to respond to active shooters when the unthinkable happens. The tactic of run, hide, fight is suggested by the FBI and its safety resources, but there is skepticism on whether it saves lives. Join in by calling 800-642-1234. Your questions, your perspective, email ideas at WPR.org. Juliet Kayyem is a former assistant secretary with the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, a senior lecturer in international security at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, and the author of books on crisis management and disaster response. Juliet, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
Good morning. You say the prevailing advice for mass shootings, the run, hide, fight protocol is not working. What is the problem?
Oh, so I want to begin this conversation by acknowledging how insane this conversation is, right? That we are having a rational conversation in a society like ours about how to protect ourselves from the mass shootings that are occurring daily, essentially, in the United States. But this is where we are. And there are lots of things we could talk about to try to prevent this, but they are going to happen until we're able to succeed. And so, for 30 years, certainly since Columbine, the advice and training that has gone on in schools and large facilities and movie theaters has always been this mantra: run, hide, fight, in that order. Run if you can, hide if you must, you know, fight as a last resort, because it was believed that engagement with the shooter obviously would be more harmful. And that essentially you're just waiting for law enforcement to come. So either run or hide till law enforcement helps you. And I have to remind people that was part of the post-Columbine thinking, because remember the high school students were all put into the library, and that's mm-hmm. where the shooters came in and most of the fatalities happened. I this is a conversation that no one wants to have. We're seeing more and more evidence. We saw it in Club Q. We saw it in a mall in Indiana. And now we saw it this weekend with the second dance hall when a young man engaged the shooter. He had already killed 10 or 11. This was the second dance hall he went to. Whether some sort of engagement, some sort of fight isn't also how we should be training for this. If you can distract the shooter, then you might be in a better position, or at least delay the kind of harm he can do, simply because the pace that these killings are occurring and the weaponry that allows these kinds of occurrences, it's just, there's not enough time for, even if you have good law enforcement, which we've seen not true in some cases, it's just not even clear there's enough time. Law enforcement in at the dance hall in California, law enforcement was there in 2 minutes and 10 seconds, and he had already shot to kill over 20 people. I mean, that's a fast response, right? I mean, so anyway, that's the thinking. No one wants to be here, but it is certainly part of some of the training that's going on in terms of how we should engage.
Zooming in for a moment, you mentioned Club Q in Colorado. In November, the unarmed man fought back, stopped a shooter. Yes. He had served 15 years in the Army. What should people without that type of combat training do?
Exactly. So, and it is a great point. And then in California, he was a young guy who looked physically strong. I was just looking at the videos of it. Look, this isn't for everyone. Okay. I mean, I am willing to admit that. I admit in my writings about this, that I'm not even prepared to tell. I want to tell my kids to do this, right? You tell your own kids, run if you can, right? So, but I do think that for if the opportunity, or if you are in a situation where this is available, and as you see, you know, are you behind the shooter? Are you in physical proximity to the shooter? Is the shooter distracted? That is where the fight comes in, right? In other words, and so I've been thinking about this because I find this the most horrific, as I said, conversation to be having in what we hope was a rational society, is we used to say run, then hide, then fight. And I think what you're starting to see is maybe it's run and hide and fight. In other words, just whatever you can do, do it, because we just cannot depend on, you know, a sort of law enforcement. Forget Uvalde and everything we saw there. And look, it's also going to be site specific. Young children don't have this ability, but a dance hall or a club or a movie theater, there might be this possibility.
You mentioned Uvalde massacre, where the reports now say systematic law enforcement failure in Uvalde. What can we learn from that?
Yeah. So, I mean, part of it, so it's two different issues in this sense. I think the run, hide, fight is really focused on the victims or potential victims, in other words, and it was based on an expectation that law enforcement could, one, get there in time, and if they were there in time, was qualified. We didn't see that in Uvalde, obviously. On the police front, there's just almost no explanation for what happened in Uvalde. I go through it. I've been in this space a long time. In my head, like, why didn't any of those hundreds of people just say, this is madness, we're going in, and there's going to be a lot of lessons learned. But that was not proper training, as we saw in California, as we saw in a lot of these instances since. Police officers are trained to go in immediately. That's what they should do. And when they don't, it is a total, you know, a violation of the public, of any public trust that we have in police officers.
You talk about an emphasis on resistance and distraction. Can you give some examples of what that might be like as in a situation like this?
Yeah. And it's so, because I mean, this is the reason why it's so site specific. So there's three sort of case studies that we are all looking at. One is an armed civilian who shoots the shooter. That's going to be, you know, this idea of a good guy with a gun is a mythology. If in America it were true that the more armed citizens we have, the safer we would be. We would be the safest country in the world, and we're clearly not in terms of our handgun and gun violence. But there is that possibility that a trained civilian would also be armed. We have found in our studies that the more weaponry there is, the more likely there is both for death and also friendly fire. So this is really about unarmed civilians. So engagement, as we've seen in some of these cases, happens when the shooter is distracted, he falls, he's reloading the gun, he's searching for a particular person. In those moments, his sights are not on the mass killing, right? His sights are on either a particular need or fixing the gun. Those are the moments when unarmed civilians have gone in, and we've seen that. So in Club Q, that was exactly the moment was the gunman was distracted, the former Army officer rushes him, he falls, and now you've bought yourself some time. And that was when you know, famously the performer there steps on him, steps on the shooter with his, with her heels. This is a, all you're trying to do is buy yourself a little bit of time. In the dance hall version, this was, that we saw the, at least the pictures of, that was something I've never seen before. That was like literally an unarmed civilian approaching someone with a gun and just saying, I'm not going to let you do this right in this room. And that just takes a level of bravery not everyone has. So I don't want people listening and saying, oh my God, I couldn't do this or whatever. This is what is happening in my field, is just an examination of all the options available. I still want people to run if they can. Hiding may be a problem if there's not an exit. And if there is an opportunity to fight and there's a person who is able to do it at the right time, yeah, do it. But remember, run, hide, fight was always that fight was like, don't do it. And now I think that there's growing evidence that it has to be one of the alternatives.
Rearranging the order, perhaps, of those words as well. Juliet Kayyem, an authority on Homeland Security and Crisis Management, senior lecturer at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Call in with your questions about the run, hide, fight template in light of recent massacres. Share what you think should be done during active shooter situations, the drills that happen at your school. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We discuss the latest research and how to protect yourself and others in the event of a mass attack, active shooter situations in public spaces. Call in with your questions, your comments. Share your plan for emergencies, 800-642-1234. We have Juliet Kayyem, former Assistant Secretary with the U.S. Department of Homeland Security and the author of books on disaster preparedness and crisis management. Juliet, the National Rifle Association has a motto that says the only way to stop a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun. We just heard you contradict that. But when you hear that type of slogan, what is problematic about it to you?
There's a couple things problematic with me. I mean, and I want to be clear to listeners, because I think the American public, and I've seen the polling, is pretty smart and wise about responsible gun ownership and the type of guns that should be on the streets. The NRA and others are fringe arguments and do not represent the community I know that are gun owners, and certainly most gun owners are responsible and are for responsible gun ownership and recognize there are certain guns that should not be on the street in any civilian context. And so when the NRA says that, they are basically promoting an industry. Remember, the NRA represents the gun industry. It does not represent gun ownership and wants more guns on the street. So the data is absolutely clear. You look at us comparatively to other countries, and you look at us over time in terms of the number of guns that have been on the streets, as well as when we have had things like assault rifle bans for that 10 years in the 20th century, that we're greater gun ownership greater gun in public facilities leads to greater escalation sooner than anyone would ever want. A permissive gun behavior that should be resolved through yelling or honking of horns, right? I mean, we used to do that when I was growing up, and does not resolve the active shooter case. There's one, the mass shooting case. I just, of all of our mass shootings, and we're now at a couple dozen just in January. There is one case that I know of which an armed civilian took out the shooter. One. Right. It is either law enforcement or it is something, you know, or it just ends or the shooter takes himself out. That's what we've put the American society. I mean, that data point is what the NRA runs with. And it's irresponsible. I mean, what they should be focused on, of course, is we have a type of weaponry on the street that is killing lots of people quickly. And and if you can just focus on speed, that's that in my world, that's what I focus on. You know, in a crisis.
But in a crisis, you freeze. Speed
is freeze.
Yes.
Right. So, and that's the problem. So you want to be able to buy time. And if there's individuals in the room who can buy time, in other words, distraction of the shooter, that seems to work really well as well.
I'm going to reintroduce you here for just a moment. Juliette Kayyem, former Assistant Secretary with the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, as we examine what people to do when facing a mass shooter incident. 800-642-1234 to join in. Turning back to schools, how should parents tell their young children to respond to mass shootings in schools? What would you suggest?
It's a different environment in schools because actually schools have been, a lot of them, you know, obviously have done active shooter drills. There's debates about how effective those active shooter drills are. And part of it is going to be age and the geography of the school. My kids are at a urban public school. It's a single building. Their only real choice is lockdown in the classrooms, which is what you want to do. And schools have become more sophisticated on that. If it's a more campusy type high school and kids are able, you still want them to run just simply because they're the target at this stage. And then this is all, as I started at the beginning, I have to say this out loud many times. I recognize these are absolutely horrifying conversations to be having as a society.
Schools have become more sophisticated. In what way?
They're basically looking at layered defenses at this stage. So that's what we do. You're not going to be able to shut down a school because schools have to have open access. But schools, in particular high schools, have gotten better. One is a lot of them do have guards or other armed people. They have locked front doors so that after the kids are in the classroom, if you're a visitor, it's harder to get in. Gating and guarding and lighting all do the trick. You have active shooter drills and lockdowns in classrooms. Those are some of the features that high schools have put into place. It hasn't solved the problem, as we've seen in a number of instances, but that when you say what has been done, there's sort of been an approach to layered defenses. None of this pales in comparison to a society that was actually willing to use political capital and to focus on both the issue of guns and, of course, mental distress essentially in young boys at this stage.
Juliette, thank you for joining us and sharing your research. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Juliette Kayyem is a former assistant secretary with the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, senior lecturer in international security at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.